So here's some exciting news from On Being Studios. Our podcast, This Movie Changed Me, is back. Each episode is hosted by our very own movie-obsessed executive producer, Lily Percy, and is like a love letter to movies and their power to teach, connect, and transform us. You don't have to have watched the movies in advance, but if you love Groundhog Day or The Wizard of Oz or Black Panther or Coco or even The Exorcist, you're already ahead. This is also a fabulous audio experience. Great thoughts, laughter, a few tears, and immersive movie music and moments. This season features conversations with Seth Godin, Naomi Alderman, and A.O. Scott. New episodes are out every Tuesday. If you haven't listened yet, it's time. Learn more, as always, at onbeing.org.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives. A powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
And so we must imagine a new country. These are words of the poet, journalist, prophet of our times, Ta-Nehisi Coates. This hour, he's with us in a conversation that is joyful and hard and kind, direct and soaring and down to earth all at once. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. We spoke at the 2017 Chicago Humanities Festival before an audience of 1,500 people. It was a beautiful cross-section of humanity, black and white, young and old. The Rockefeller Memorial Chapel was brimming with energy, and the technology didn't play along, so we ended up adding an extra microphone as the conversation began.
Okay, so we're going to... It feels kind of old-fashioned, which is kind of refreshing, maybe, except you don't like holding a microphone.
I actually have three...
I know. I know you have to forget about
because
the other two.
Because what I have to say is so powerful that it requires evidently three microphones.
Okay, it's an honor to be here with all of you and with Ta-Nehisi Coates. And I always start my conversations, whoever I'm speaking with, asking about the spiritual background of your childhood. I wonder how, one thing that you've written a lot about your childhood, you've written, for example, that you didn't have Christian optimism, you had physicality and chaos. If I ask you about the spiritual background of your childhood, where do you start? Where's your mind go?
The first thing I think about is in absence of it. Because the African-American community, obviously the black church is so important. And it was important for my cousins, and it was important for my grandmother, and it was so absent in my house. I mean, this is probably not the way to think about spirituality, but as a child, what I understood is that people got gifts on Christmas, and I did not. And so there was this absence. Okay, these people are religious. I'm not, you know. Having said that, I grew up, you know, as I think about it, I grew up with a heavy sense of what I would not call ancestor worship, but I would call ancestor reverence. Mm. So there's a strong sense that people before you had sacrificed, and they were the reasons why you would be there. I can remember like being a child and going to like various political events in the African-American community, and there was this whole tradition of saying libations. You know, where you poured water into a plant, the plant representing the earth, and, you know, folks had gone back to the earth. And you would say names, and those names could be, you know, anybody from Malcolm X to Toussaint Louverture to your Aunt Grace to whoever it was who you felt had somehow sacrificed for you to be there. And it wasn't until, see, this is why you had this job, because it wasn't until you asked that question.
It's that a great question, isn't it?
No, it is a great question. Yeah. It's a great question. You're shaming me as a journalist. But it wasn't until you asked that I connected that to, because I talk about that actually a lot in my writing.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, here's something you wrote in your new book, in We Were 8 Years in Power, which is really fantastic. You wrote, I can somehow remember all that I did not allow myself to feel walking away from that unemployment office and through the Harlem streets that day, just as I remember all that I did not let myself feel in those young years trapped between the schools and the street. And I know that there are black boys and girls out there lost in a Bermuda Triangle of the mind or stranded in the doldrums of America, some of them treading and some of them drowning, never feeling and never forgetting. And you know, that's spiritual background too.
Why?
That's...
No, I'm serious. Why?
Because I feel like that feeling or not allowing ourselves to feel, that Bermuda Triangle of the mind, to me, it's inner life, which is just a way to talk about spiritual life. It may not be the way everyone defines it.
I think about that, and I talk about this in Between the World and Me, and I guess it's kind of highfalutin as that might sound. Well, I mean, I don't know any, I think about neurons.
Yeah.
When I hear that. And I recognize that when I'm writing, I'm, doing something else, right? I'm talking about it. Sentence would not sound the same if I said, certain neurons in my brain fired and then, that doesn't quite convey the feeling. It's so funny. I mean, I don't mean to say it's not spiritual. It's just not as when I write.
Yeah.
It's not what I think about. Which does not mean it's not there, I guess. But it's not the process. It's interesting that you receive it that way, though.
I mean, one thing, kind of where you are writing and thinking these days, takes off a little bit, and in some ways your career, from this, that place, and in that same season that you were in that Harlem unemployment line, the campaign was starting for Barack Obama, who would become the first mm-hmm. black president.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the problem of the color line, which was language of W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. It's just a thread that runs through. It's been your fascination. Do you remember when you first read that?
Read Du Bois, or when I became first aware?
When you read Color Line and when that captured your imagination, what happened?
I had to read Souls of Black Folk at a very, very young age. I mean, I probably was 9 or 10.
Yeah.
My parents, there was this book I had, and for some reason it had Up From Slavery, Souls of Black Folk, and I want to say Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man in the same book. You have to understand how I was raised. There were just books everywhere. And in my house, about 90% of those books were either by or about black people or the black diaspora in some respect.
Your father was a librarian.
He was. My father was a research librarian, and he, had loved books. So that mm-hmm. sort of thing, it would have just been around. And I read it, and then at the same time, I got to say, I didn't get it. It's probably only in the last 5 to 8 years, as, articulating that book, that I got it. I didn't understand blackness and whiteness and white supremacy as central to American history. And there are people around me that said that, they would say, this country is built on our back. But I would wonder why. How do you illustrate that? What does that mean? And I guess, and now I'm getting to the answer to your question. it probably was actually during my studies of the Civil War that I got it, that what he meant by being the problem of not just the problem for black people, not just something that people should not do, but a thread that ran through all of American history, mm-hmm. During that period. And, thinking on it now, he probably underestimated,
Yeah, I mean, he said the problem of the 20th century is the color line, and for you, color line shapeshifts, but it doesn't go away, and it's with us in the 21st.
Yeah, and it probably was the problem of the 18th, 19th, 20th, and hopefully not 21st, but not looking like that.
Mm-hmm. You talked about neurons a minute ago, and I do feel like one frontier we're on of advance is understanding our brains better,
mm-hmm.
and that, in fact, the color line is in our heads,
mm-hmm.
and it's we change laws, right? I mean, you go through this history of the Civil War and Reconstruction and how betrayed the promise mm-hmm. of those events were
mm-hmm.
because we didn't change ourselves. Ultimately.
Yeah, and I think that's hard for people to accept. I guess the place, in terms of the book, that I, you know, most recently encountered it is the implicit idea that you know, President Obama was prone to repeating, that, you know, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice, right? And I mean, that sort of, you know, notion of destiny, you know what I mean? I don't know how you measure that against the very human practice of repeating, you know, brutality over and over again. And beyond that, like, what about the people who, what if you don't believe in humanity as this kind of collective, but believe that every individual life is, a unit in and of itself? And when that life is snuffed out, that arc is over. And so people who were lynched are not a part of a long-term historical process, that in their minds, that's their life. And history ended the minute they were snuffed out. And so, you know, this kind of providential understanding makes them bricks in a road. Mm-hmm. In order to give it a happy ending, in order to say it was all worth it. But I maintain it was never worth it. It was never just. It was never right. The process is never, it's always wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always wrong. And I think it, I think there are a lot of things implicit in that that devalue, I would probably say not just the lives of African Americans, but the lives of people who live, you know, underneath of the boot.
And actually are demean the lives of white people too.
Yes.
If not in the sense of being on the other end of violence in the same way. You know, you say this, you're really fascinated with the Civil War. You're really a student of the Civil War. You say something interesting I've never heard anybody talk about in this way before, that, or just kind of, you know, it's one of these kind of very simple truths that someone suddenly puts words around and you see it. That there's this, you say, for black people, there is this, the burden of taking the Civil War as our war. Even that piece of our history is a history of white people. Right? And that's, I don't know.
The trouble with this book is I don't remember everything I wrote.
Okay, all right.
I mean, I can say something.
Yeah,
though. I can dance. I can still dance.
I think, yeah, but so let's, like, so.
No, because it's like eight pieces that I wrote over the course of eight, and I did reread all of those pieces when I was writing, I guarantee you. But I just, yeah, I don't remember everything.
Okay.
But I can, like I said,
I've been there.
Okay.
No, but okay, so the story, so where we are and right. What you're writing to, and you become a voice of this, mm-hmm. is this shocking thing that I think so many of us have woken up to, that 50 years after the Civil Rights Movement, 50 mm-hmm. years after the March on Washington, even in the years of a black president, mm-hmm. How do you say it? You know, that, well, also just that you grew up, I mean, the Between the World and Me was really a dominant theme of that, was the fear in your body, mm-hmm. for your children. And one thing, and the vast energy that consumes, and what you said is, you know, we suddenly, some of us, suddenly saw that young black men and women were not safe on our streets, not safe in their own neighborhoods. And one thing you said is, it's the cameras that are new, not the violence.
Yeah, no, I think, I think technology has always played this role. For instance, it's not like the first time, you know, John Lewis, you know, those marches were beaten crossing the
yeah.
That wasn't the first time it happened.
Yeah.
You know, it was just suddenly you had news cameras, you know, it could be
but
seen.
That was an amazing story, actually, how everybody was watching the same channel back then.
Right.
And what movie, it was some movie.
Oh, I have no
about,
idea. You probably know
it was like a movie about Nazi Germany, and then that people started being beat on this bridge in
Selma.
Did they
Selma, like cut the movie
and
then
cut
they
through to the movie, and they showed Americans not being treated like people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't
You're
even
right.
know that. But that wasn't, but like that wouldn't have been possible 20, 30 years
yeah.
before. You know, it was
yeah.
the technology that suddenly made it visible. And I think, you know, it's the same thing here. You know, my previous book, Between the World and Me, is about a friend of mine who was killed by the police. There were no camera phones, there was no Twitter, there was no anything, you know, and he just.
And that was Prince?
Prince Jones, yeah. Yes.
And when was that, like 2000?
2000,
early 2000s?
Fall of 2000 he was killed.
Yeah.
And he was just swallowed into the abyss with all the lives of other, you know, black people who, you know, had been snuffed out in similar ways, just sort of were forgotten, you know? And now people, you know, can see it.
Yeah.
The question remains how much that actually changes, though. Philando Castile was killed on camera. Nothing happened. Argana was choked on camera. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know, no one went to jail. And so the question becomes, how much does this actually change?
And I told you before we walked out here that I'm not going to ask you to be optimistic.
Okay, but now you are?
No, I'm not. Like, I was, because I see that everywhere you go, you're telling this truth.
Uh-huh.
And then white people want you to say, okay, so where can we find our hope? And yeah. I was watching you on Colbert recently. Somebody saw that. You know, he really wanted you to give hope. I mean, here's what I find. You know, when you write, our story is a tragedy, I know it sounds odd, but that belief does not depress me. It focuses me.
Well, I believe that. I don't remember when I wrote it, but it's true. Well,
I mean, you have... Yeah.
I do
mean,
believe
you don't,
that.
You don't have hope, or you don't want to use that word.
No, you are.
But there's a focus. There's an energy.
You know what it is. Mm. I don't actually think I'm that singular in this. I don't know, and I don't know if there are journalists here, but you have to understand that's my training. I was trained as a journalist.
Yeah.
Journalists go out and look for things that are wrong in the world, and then they write them.
Yeah.
And it is not the case that your editor says, okay, that's a cool story, but there's no hope at the end.
Right.
That's not a thing editors say to journalists.
Yeah.
Which is what I am. And so it's not so much that I even object to hope. You know, it's just that the thing I do, that's not a criteria for it. You know what I mean?
It's not your calling.
No, I mean, it's just not what I, and you know, the other things that influenced me, I was before that, I was hugely influenced by poetry. Poets are not acts to be hopeful.
Yeah.
When I was in college and I did go to school, I was a history major. That had a huge influence on me. If you want to be depressed, you should go to the University of Chicago's history department.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm not sure why I get the question. Not that you asked the question.
You know, where I find you to be closest to what I think other people are wanting from you, mm-hmm. when they want you to be hopeful, is when you write and speak about Malcolm X.
Huh.
You know, you...
Yeah, he gave me hope.
He presented more than anybody else the possibility of what you call collective self-creation.
Right. Well, you know what? I would listen to his lectures, and I just felt free. Like, it's not like hope, like... It's like what, I think what people want is tell us that we're going to get past
this.
That
it's going to be okay.
Tell us it's going to be okay, right? Yeah. So that's one thing, right? Yeah. But there's a different kind of hope. There are people in the world who accept that their life ends in death, and that's bad, but that's what's going to happen. And then within that, they find, you know, joys and hopes, you know, in between. Oh, I have the ability. So for Malcolm, to me, it was I can speak about the world in a way that is reflective of my life and my community. I can do that. I don't have to calibrate my speech. I don't have to calibrate how I look. I don't have to calibrate how I walk to make other people feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. Like, I have that right. And so that was, like, big for me as a writer. Like, when I started writing, there was a school of writing that says, given that the audience is obviously, when you reach to any size, is not going to be majority black, that you have to hold people's hands, you have to explain to them, you know, and the Malcolm influence on me said, you know, no, you don't. Write as you hear it. Write as you hear it. And in fact, I don't even think that's a particular black thing, because if you're black in this world and you... are going to become educated on the, you know, what is considered mainstream art in this world, mainstream traditions, nobody slows down for you. Nobody is going to hold your hand.
Right.
You know what I mean? And explain, you know, the Brady Bunch to you. Nobody's going to do that. Catch up. Catch up. Some people live like this. I know it's not what's around you, but some people live like that. Catch up. You know what I mean? We're on the next. You know what I mean? And that's just how it is. You got to be, you know, bilingual. You got to, you know, figure it out. You know what I mean? So if they have the right to talk and write like that, I have the right to write about Wu-Tang like that. Like, I can do that. I can say, catch up. Catch up. You know what I mean? Like, I can do that. And that's a kind of, you know, freedom.
I'm Krista Tippett, today with journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates as part of On Being's Civil Conversations Project.
You use this phrase, black atheism, which I think means more than just atheism, that there's something in those two words together. But part of that, for a while, included this certainty that nobody would take you seriously. And yet, you're taken very seriously. I mean, how do you understand what's going on that all these people are here, that white people like what you write and read your books and buy your books?
How do I understand it?
Don't hold our hands.
No, I'm not.
Tell
I'm not,
it straight.
I'm not. Because the truth is that I don't understand it, but I'm going to try to think my way through it. Perhaps it's a simple answer, okay? I think white people are human beings.
Thank you.
I think white people are human beings. Yeah. Because the question, and I admit I've asked the question, presumes a kind of a distance that may not be there. Like there isn't anything universal or humanistic in the black struggle that can, you know, reach other people. So I think white people are human beings. I think black people are human beings too. I think the experience of black people in this country, you know, as I was saying, in terms of Du Bois, runs right down the middle, you know, of the country. Like, you can't, you know, really talk about the country without it. But I also think it's reflective of so many other struggles. Like, at its root, it's power. And I think that the struggle, even though this is the lens we see it through here in America, is actually quite old. I mean, obviously, there are particular details to it. But at its root, it's not a particular thing. I think that's it. I think that's it.
You know, so Ruby Sales, who is one of the civil rights leaders, mm-hmm. You know, said to me last year that a central quality of this moment we inhabit is a crisis of whiteness. Mm. You have this quote from James Baldwin that really stuck out at me. White people in this country will have quite enough to do in learning how to accept and love themselves and each other. And when they have achieved this, which will not be tomorrow and may very well be never, the Negro problem will no longer exist, for or will no longer be needed.
No one will need it. Yo, when I read that, that was like getting hit by a truck. Like, it was so profound, because what he was saying was that there is no Negro problem. And that's how it's always, you know, historically been talked. Oh, there's a, you know, even not the problem of the color line. No, there's no problem of the color line. The problem is over here. It's not us. We actually are, you know, quite human. It is, and I think what he's referring to, you know, all of the things that a group of people do to remain in power, to hold that boot on somebody's neck. So as Jefferson said, you know, hold the wolf by the ear. That was how he talked about, mm-hmm. you know, slavery, you know, enslavement.
And then there's this irony that I'm so acutely aware of right now as I'm talking to you. You know, what is it? I just want to see, I took all these notes. You know, you write things like this. I can't find it. I mean, it's all over the place.
Just pick one.
In America, it is traditional to destroy the black body. It is heritage. And you are right. And I carry that in my body, mm-hmm. right? In my white body, I carry that cruelty and that violence. And what do you say to people when they ask you that? Like, what do I do with my whiteness, the legacy of my whiteness?
Excuse my language, but I tell them to do the same thing I do with the legacy of my niggerness, and that is work for a world where my grandchildren and likely, you know, great, great, great grandchildren are not niggas, and that they should work for a world where their grandchildren and great, great grandchildren are not white.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's because what that question presumes is a kind of, well, is there some immediate action I can do?
Yeah.
You know, to
no,
get
this
out
is
of
like
this.
Generational.
Yeah, no,
work
and there's
lifetime.
No immediate action that I can do to get out of this.
Right.
You know, what the realization is that, you know, me and you are here trapped together. You know what I mean? That you're as trapped as I am. That once you are aware, you know, you're in the cage too. It's a different kind of cage, a gilded cage, but it's a cage.
Yeah.
It's a cage. Yeah. It's a cage. No, it's a real cage. And that there's no real thing that will probably save you in this lifetime. But why should it? How long did it take to build this? You know, you're just becoming aware of something that, you know, of a process that was going on long, you know, but before you were born. So I think it's natural that the first thing you say is, how can I get out?
Yeah.
That quote about it being tradition. And I'm not like saying that for effect.
Oh no, like, I know.
No, I'm not saying. Yeah. I'm saying as a way to answer your question.
Yeah.
That is just another way of saying that from 1619 to 1865, it was legal to torture black people. It just was.
Yeah.
It just was. That period is in fact longer than the period of freedom. And for 100 years after that, it was basically legal to lynch black people. That was fine. That was accepted.
Yeah.
And in the period after that, it is now basically legal for someone, you know, with a badge, if they feel afraid, to kill you. That compiles.
Yeah.
It compiles over time. It has effects. And so, you know, the notion that, you know, you can just dance your way, like, that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen. If it took this long to get into this, it's worth asking yourself how long it's going to take to get out of it.
Yeah. you wrote a piece called The Case for Reparations, and I think that feels to me like it's an important message you're carrying. I just found this, you know, just this sentence in your writing about that, you know, just kind of, and so we must imagine a new country. I'll just read a little bit more of this. It's because it's very powerful and also beautifully written. Reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequence, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. The recovering alcoholic may well have to live with his illness for the rest of his life, but at least he is not living a drunken lie. Reparations beckon us to reject the intoxication of hubris and see America as it is, the work of fallible humans.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. That's it. I mean, and what what a lot of people want to do is they want to live the drunken lie. You know, they want to, you know, I was working on that piece and it was like, because what people will tell you is, well, I didn't have any slaves. I wasn't alive when this happened.
Right.
My ancestors just got here. And what became clear to me, you know, reading that is, okay, but you cook out on the 4th of July. Your ancestors weren't here. They played no role in that. They had nothing to do with it. You take off for President's Day, but you had no part in that. Your ancestors weren't here. There are a number of patriotic rituals that folks have no problem participating in as long as they can get credit for it. But they don't want the debits, see? You know, I want the paycheck. I don't want to write a check, though. And that is a kind of, you know, in the piece, I think I talk about it, like, as a la carte patriotism.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sometimes friendship, you know what I mean? I'm there when I can get some, but when it's, you know, gets tough, man, I'm out. I had nothing to do with that. You know, but it's like either you're in or you're out. Either you're part of it or you're not. I was not alive during the Korean War. Had nothing to do with it, but, you know, my taxes go to pay, you know, pensions, you know, for folks to this day. You know, I would not have been my choice to invade Iraq, but my tax dollars went to it. That's the way a state works, you know? And so I think what people want is they want to be a part of the state as long as it gives them something that they like.
I wonder, some of the ways I've processed this last few years and what happened is that the election of Barack Obama, the election of a black man to president of the United States, was this magnificent accomplishment that actually at the time was celebrated even by most Americans and people around the world in its magnificence. And that what we didn't understand is that that would also surface all the unfinished work we have to do to be worthy of that accomplishment. And that's what's right out on the surface now. But I wonder, like, that's how I've thought it through. And I wonder how you, and I don't know if you like that way I've phrased it.
No, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah? Oh, good. Well, that makes me happy. I mean, you know.
You could do my job. You were 8 years in power. You could do this.
No, I mean, you know, you've said Obama's rise offered you the chances to see that our theory of providence and progress that would continue was to see that as the illusion that it was. So, yeah, I would just...
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I think people saw all the celebration and all the, you know, good feeling that was generated and... They never considered there were other people who were feeling a different kind of way. You know? All of these questions go back to the question of patriotism, right? And I don't know what country that's done this yet, but, you know, let's take Americans at their word. Let's take the country at its word. It says it's exceptional. It says it's different. So let's try to do something different. You have to love your country the way you love your friends, the way your spouse loves you, right? The people who love you don't blow smoke up your backside. They don't do that. They don't do that. They tell you, you know, hard truths. They love you, but, you know, my wife, you know, if something's going wrong, she's going to tell me. Something's going wrong, I'm going to tell her. That's the yeah. Nature of the relationship. Don't mean I don't back her. Don't mean I don't support her. But when is love between individuals this kind of uncompromising, never questioning? That ain't no love. That ain't no love that I would, you know, tell my kid to identify,
right.
You know, in his partner, in his friends. The question, you know, really is, can you get to a place where, and I don't know how you do this, but can you get to a place where citizens, you know, are encouraged to see themselves critically, encouraged to see their history critically. I don't know, but that strikes me as what's necessary.
After a short break, more with journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates. This episode is part of On Being's Civil Conversations Project, an evolving adventure in audio, events, resources, and initiatives for planting relationship and conversations around the subjects we fight about intensely and those we've barely begun to discuss. To learn more, visit civilconversationsproject.org.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. Harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. To learn more, subscribe to their newsletter, Possibilities, and discover the work Templeton supports on topics from curiosity and kindness to evolution, black holes, and the origins of life. Sign up at templeton.org/possibilities.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with poet, journalist, prophet Ta-Nehisi Coates in a live event as part of the 2017 Chicago Humanities Festival. The crowd of 1,500 submitted questions, and there was time for a few, read by artistic director Allison Cuddy.
So the first question is, how has your Howard experience continued to influence you? And it's signed, Heart Shape, HU!!!
Oh, you clearly didn't go to Howard. That is not how you say it. It had a tremendous influence on me. I didn't know there were black people who liked Marilyn Manson. I wasn't aware of that. I didn't know there were black people who had so much money that their parents sent them to school with a car. I didn't know that existed. To put this in perspective, I was the first place where I encountered open LGBT people, period. Of any, you know what I mean, any race, it was the first place I saw that. I could walk up on that yard and find people who were deeply into politics. I could find folks that were interested in marketing. I could find folks that were gonna be doctors one day. I could find folks that wanted to be in musical theater. It was all the various 10,000 black people in one spot. And they were beautiful. I mean, just physically beautiful people. You have to understand what that means when you grow up in a culture where black people are not depicted as beautiful. It's just not there. There's a subconscious message that is communicated in the culture that this is what's beautiful, this is what's elegant, this is what's intelligent, this is what's sophisticated, and this is white. It's not you. And for 4 years, man, I just got shot with an antidote to all of that. And so when I left, sans diploma, but when I left, I felt like I could fight anybody. You understand? Like, I felt like I had no fear of, you know, anybody, you know, having, you know, went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, UChicago. I didn't care. I fight anybody. You know what I mean? Like, I felt so armed and confident. It's the seed of why, you know, I write sentences like that. I don't care. I don't care because I know that it's a group of people that I was, who I came of age with, who know exactly what I'm talking about. It was incredible. It's the seed of everything.
What advice would you give on how to best teach history in a way that is honest and accurate?
I have no teaching advice at all. I was a terrible student. You know, I failed my way through high school. I don't know how I got into Howard University, but I failed my way through that too. I don't know. I don't know. I have horrible advice in terms of teaching. I'm serious. Because one of the things that annoys me is people act like they know everything, right?
Idea.
You know, they just stand up, I'm gonna answer everything. No, you don't know. Come on, be clear about what you know and what you don't know. And I don't, come on.
Yeah.
All right, I'm 17 years old, and my generation does not know how to deal with the older generation's stubbornness and unwillingness to change, even though they are in power. What advice do you have?
Can you repeat that question? What?
It's a good one. I'm 17 years old, and my generation does not know how to deal with the older generation's stubbornness and unwillingness to change, even though they are in power. What advice do you have?
Okay, I'm gonna talk about why I don't know. And listen, here's the thing that happens. Here's the thing that happens. You are well-researched and knowledgeable about one thing that you've been thinking about a long time, and you've been reading about a long time. That does not make you well-researched and knowledgeable about all things. These are, for instance, that question right there, there are people, activists, who spend their lives grappling with that and have spent their lives grappling. I'm a writer. I prefer solitude. I prefer to be alone. I prefer to, you know, some distance, you know, from struggle. I like that. That's my joy. That's my life experience. Because I think, like, there's this tradition. I get, like, this title, like, public intellectual, and I don't like it. Because what it sounds to me is like, you know, people who BS, you know what I mean? Like, they're smart about one thing, and so, you know, they play into this notion that they're smart about everything else. I have not struggled with that at all. I haven't. And so, like, for me to answer would be to pretend as though I had. Does that, like, if you want to ask me about, like, writing, I can, you know what I mean, up one side, down the other. I got you. I'm with you. Because I've struggled with that. I think about it. I was thinking about it on the plane today. You know? I can't address things that are not things that I've actually struggled with. I'm sorry. I really apologize. Are there two more or something?
There's one more.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. There's one more.
This is not going well.
It all comes down to this one. So this is not a question about hope, but it may be related. And it's from North Shore County Day School middle school teachers. So it's back to teachers. It's how can we help our students remain optimistic under this administration?
Oh my God, are you serious?
When we ourselves are struggling. So.
Why would I know that? Okay. I'm gonna try. I have to try. How do you help your kids? So I probably reject the premise of the question. If I were in your class and I put myself back there, I don't think even at that age I was looking for hope from my teachers. I think I was looking for enlightenment from my teachers. I think I was looking for exposure. I think I wanted to see other things about the world. I think I wanted to be exposed to different worldviews. I think I, like, if I were a kid right now, I guess I would want to understand, like, why did they kill Eric Garner? Like, why is that okay? And the answer doesn't have to, you know, like, I don't need you to make me feel good about that. But I need to know what happened. And people deeply underestimate the freedom that comes for at least understanding. It's like, it's one thing to be terminally ill, right? Like, that's bad enough. But to not understand what's happening to your body. And that's kind of the position I found myself in as a young black. I didn't understand why when I walked out on the street and say it was a girl I liked that lived across North Avenue. Why do I have to bring seven other dudes with me to go see this girl? And when I cut on TV and see the Wonder Years, Kevin Arnold can just take his bike and go see Winnie Cooper. Why? Like, what, like, I understand why in terms of the dudes, but what specifically is the process that put, so I probably would want to be pointed, not even would want the answers. Give me the tools. Arm me. Allow me to be able to understand why. You know, that probably would be more important to me. That's not hope. That's not hope. But I think that's the sort of perspective I would have come from at that age.
I'm Krista Tippett, today with poet, journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, as part of On Being's Civil Conversations Project.
Hope is not your word. It's not what you offer. But I'm really struck with how you really care about beauty. Mm-hmm. You're passionate about beauty. Mm-hmm. And you're a poet.
Mm-hmm. I was.
You were. But I think you write poetically.
Thank you.
Right? I mean, you work at that.
I do.
Yeah. I love the way you write about that. Or I don't know if I saw an interview you gave where I once talked to a scholar of the Hebrew prophets. Mm-hmm. And he said, the prophets are also always poets. Mm. Because you have to speak in language that is disarming mm-hmm. and that reaches people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was really struck at the beginning of your new book, We Were 8 Years in Power. You wrote about the process. You said, you know, that this was created from articles that had been written. And you said, but I also had an urge to make something new of them. This book is made in this way because I enjoyed the challenge of doing so. If I can communicate half of that joy to you, then I will have done my job. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like that joy that we've also like experienced tonight is so much who you are rather than, as I said, you know, when Between the World and Me came out, there was this idea of you as angry.
Right.
So, I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here right. as we finish, but I don't know what this sparks in you.
Well, it was I always try to, you know, do two things in the nonfiction, and that is, I do want the argument to be logically correct and to be on point. But, like, that's not enough. It's not enough for you to read that and, you know, walk away and say, that seems correct. Mm-hmm. You know, the writing should be haunting. Mm-hmm. You know, I use that word a lot. Like, you should really feel it in your bones. Like, you should be disturbed the way I was disturbed. When I was doing the last piece in the book, my president was black. I was not sure who was going to win the election, but I wanted folks to feel something about that piece. I just didn't want it to be like a correct piece. So I would play Marvin Gaye's Distant Lover over and over again. And there was something so beautifully wordless in that song, like this longing. The lyrics are actually really simple, but it's the way he mixes this, like this beautiful falsetto that Marvin has, you know, this kind of, you know, raspy, you know, soul piece that he has, and he pulls it all together in such a way that you're like, wow, like my wife is right here, but I miss her too. You know, I feel like, you know, you left me. You know, he says, you know, when you left, you took all of me with you. Yeah, that's how I feel. I feel that right now, even though you're right here. And I wanted people to feel that. You know, I wanted them to feel, you know, like, you know, watch that footage of Obama and Michelle and feel when you left, you took all of me with you. Like, you should feel that. You know what I mean? Like, it should be in you. You know what I mean? When you read that piece, you know what I mean? Because I there was a kind of sadness that I could see, you know, among all the black people I knew. You know what I mean? All of them. And I'm not saying it wasn't a sadness among other people, but this is just, you know, get to the general about a specific, and the specific I knew were the black people I was around, and they knew. And they knew this even if Hillary had won, that the last 8 years had been something that they had never expected, that it was a beautiful thing to be represented in that way. And that's, you know, I'm talking about separate from policy, whatever policy disagreements I have.
Yeah.
But we, you know, as black folks, we always, like, gotta defend somebody. You know what I mean? And that was, like, a feeling about so many public black people. Like, you know, you gotta defend hip-hop. I love hip-hop. But it's like, you gotta defend it. It's always, like, an argument, you know, defend. And you never had to defend Barack and Michelle in that way, right? Like, you didn't have to do that. Like, it was liberating. And again, I just want to be clear. I'm talking about, like, I got my policy differences, which is something else.
Yep.
But as a public image, you don't have to apologize for them. You don't have to do any of that. You know what I mean? They never made you hang your head. You were never ashamed. And when that went, you know, it was a particular kind of sadness that came. And I was trying to drill as much of that sadness in there.
Right.
It's not enough to just have the facts right.
Right.
You got to get all of that in there, and that becomes word choice and sentences and going over the sentences over and over and over and over again.
Thank you. But I think what that words that are poetic and disturb and that disturb, mm-hmm. that what that makes possible, that is actually really rare in America, has become rare in America, that I think we're trying to relearn, is disturbing, and yet you stay with it, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why white people love your books, and like why they're good for us.
Let's just really quick. let me see that for
one
second.
Okay.
White people don't love my books. So, like, I just want to be clear. The people who read books is a minority. I just want to be really clear about that.
Right. Okay.
There are a lot of white people who don't love my books. That's why you had to go through security on your way in, by the way. Let's just be clear.
Okay. Now we're threatening to take
an
unacceptable detour here at the end. Why you have become a voice in this moment, because we do, some of us, a lot of us, I think, do want to be telling these hard truths and feeling them in our bodies. And so there is an art to being able to articulate that so that it can hurt and it can be shameful and it can be disturbing, and yet we can keep listening and keep thinking about it.
I hope so.
Okay. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you so much. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. His books include The Beautiful Struggle, Between the World and Me, and most recently, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. He's also the current writer of the Marvel Comics, The Black Panther, and Captain America. The On Being Project is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
Zach Rose,
Siri Grassley,
Nicole Finn,
and Colleen Scheck.
Special thanks this week to Allison Cuddy, Tiffany Beatty, Kate Samuels, Heidi Hewitt, Rena Rinaldi, Zachary Williams, Brian Johnson, Alexa Perlmutter, Rory Friedman, Claire Liu, Joe Baruch, and Gautam Srikishan. The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice that you hear singing at the end of our show is Cameron Kinghorn. On Being is an independent production of the On Being Project. It's distributed to public radio stations by PRX. I created this show at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The George Family Foundation, in support of the Civil Conversations Project. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is produced by On Being Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota.